Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by Stephen Colgrave. He's the executive editor of Byline Times, which he co-founded along with Byline TV with the author, playwright and literary critic Peter Jukes. The Byline Times is a fearless independent newspaper featuring a daily national news and investigation site that is all about what the papers don't print. He also co-founded the Byline Festival, the world's only festival for independent journalism and free speech, where you can dance, discuss, laugh, and change the world. In addition, he's a trustee of both the Young Actor Theatre and Uprising, is a fellow of the British American Project, and on the advisory board of the Artists Legacy Group. Stephen has considerable communications experience, including 10 years with Saatchi & Saatchi, where he was the CEO in Prague and also the marketing director, EMEA. He's also produced films including Bring Me the Head of Mavis Davis and has published several books including Punk and Inside Music. His next is What the Papers Don't Say, care of the mighty Unbound Publishing. So, Stephen, hi, and how are you?
Very good, thanks, Sean. Good to be on your podcast.
Oh, very kind of you. I know it's a really sort of a swift run through your glittering background.
Sean, I'm very old. That's why I've done so much. It's just because I'm ancient. In fact, my daughter tells me I'm a walking piece of social history, really.
Well, there we are. The last time I saw you, you were just walking along with Pussy Riot and Gavin Turk. So there we are. So in terms of being culturally right on it. So go on then. So just talk us through how and why you set up Byline in all its permutations. And just take us through that.
Well, Byline was originally set up by one of my very best friends, Peter Jukes, who I've known for 21, 22 years. And he was consulting for a thing called Byline, which had been set up by some dot-com entrepreneurs who'd managed to get a lot of money to create a site. And the original idea was a crowdfunded site for journalism. In fact, I think it was meant to be citizen journalism. And I think very quickly they realized it wasn't going to quite work as they wanted, and they offered to hand it over to Peter. Peter then asked me if I thought he should take over Byline. And I said yes, and I think we were in the pub or something. So then Peter rang me up and said, look, you know, could you come and help me? So that's sort of how we started with Byline. The reason behind setting up that crowdfunded site for journalism was that it was just early 2016. What had sort of happened in 2015 was that Google had taken about $1.5 billion. The figures might not be quite right, but they'd taken a huge amount of money out of advertising, out of both daily press and national press. If you think about all the classified ads and all the other advertising, it all went onto Google, which really meant that the press was in a very parlous state. And things like investigative journalism, which is the expensive bit of journalism, were really being cut drastically. And so there were some fantastic journalists around. And the idea we had was get them up on a platform. This is Peter's idea. Give them a platform and give them the tools to go and crowdfund so that they could put up an article. And if people liked it, they could pop some money towards them with some rewards and things to keep them writing. So that was the idea of Byline, byline.com, which we then developed between us. And we thought it was great. It was all created on Twitter, but we had a feeling that we were just talking to a relatively small number of Twitter followers, really, who were incredibly engaged in what we were doing. But we wanted to get to a larger group of people. And I think what happened was the Brexit referendum had just gone, in our terms, the wrong way. And Trump had just been sort of elected in America. And our feeling was it all seemed a bit dark and seemed that fake news had started, which is something I know, Sean, you've been very exercised about. And this whole concept of fake news and social media, you know, we'd already knew a little bit about Cambridge Analytica from Carol Cadwallader. We could see that, you know, this sort of the importance of truth and proper information was going to be the big challenge, really, which it has been over the last 4 or 5 years. And so we wanted to set up a festival. And the idea of the festival was we'd go to the forest in Ashdown Forest and we would get thousands of people to come along and we would have music and we'd have comedy, but we'd also have these talk tents with lots of panel sessions with journalists talking. And this had really come about because very early on when we were doing Byline.com, we realized it was quite tough to make money on crowdfunding. But we did the first event, I think we did at Escargo. And I think we charged £10 for each for people. And we had to shut the doors when the 100 people had come because we only had a capacity for about 80. Mm. We suddenly realized that nobody wants to pay for journalism, but they will pay to come and see journalists because journalists are very erudite and they talk about very interesting things. So that was really the genesis of then creating the festival, which I know you came to, Sean, and that was sort of exciting. So it's a bit of a long-winded story, but really part of wanting to try to get to a larger audience all the time with journalism. I mean, the thing about I don't know about you, but you know, when I was a kid, I was quite intrigued by journalism. You know, and if you think about all those great films, you know, like even the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, that's all about journalism, the excitement of investigative journalism. Mm. And it just seemed to me that actually somehow journalism had changed into tabloid hacks and phone hacking and all this sort of stuff, and it had lost that sort of really interesting, exciting stuff about going and holding society to account, you know, the fourth estate and everything. And we just felt we wanted to get people really interested, show them great journalism again, get them excited about them, make them feel part of it. So we then decided to set up Byline Times. I think it was the second festival that stupidly we announced at the end of the festival, we're going to set up a newspaper. And everyone thought we were crazy, but fortunately we managed to go and find some seed money because it's not cheap to set up a paper. And and we set up Byline Times. And it's a daily news site, as you said, but also the great thing is there's a monthly physical newspaper that people subscribe for. And you know, like all these things, Sean, we hadn't really thought about that. I'm an old ad man, so I thought we'd get loads of advertising on this daily news site. And so we just printed a paper. We did a launch party with, you know, lots of famous people we knew. And we did this launch party. And we said, as a giveaway, you know, we'll print a paper, a bit like, you know, a giveaway bag type thing, you know, going home present. So we printed the paper and everyone loved the paper. They all said, how do we buy it? How do we, whatever? And suddenly we realized that we could sell the paper. So actually what we do is we give the news site for nothing and we sell this newspaper on a subscription. And now we have over 12,000 people who subscribe to this paper and it means that we are now breaking even. So, you know, it's a funny thing, life, isn't it? You end up finding the thing you didn't really think about takes off. And now actually we don't take any advertising at all because we actually find that, you know, our independence, because we're all about being fearless and independence, our independence is even stronger if we're not taking any advertising. So we just have subscribers. And our subscribers really, you know, we send them an email every week. We encourage them to come back to us with comments. And, you know, our Twitter feed breaks all the rules. You know, we have a stream of content going all day, which everyone in social media tells me is totally wrong, but people love it. And so that's it. We've tried to build a sort of, I hate that word movement, I say more of a family, to sort of get people really interested again in journalism and wanting to support it and be part of it. And it's been a phenomenal ride, actually, something that Peter and I never expected it to get to where it has. And then we decided to set up a TV station, which is our next mad adventure, which we're doing now. So that is Byline. It's not really a company. I keep saying with Peter, it's an adventure, really. And along the way, we've just sort of managed to sort of somehow find these amazing people who support us and love being part of it.
Fantastic. I mean, it's absolutely superb stuff. And I mean, I think what would be really interesting is to perhaps go through some of the like sort of highlights along the way. So you mentioned there in terms of going back to the sort of the early days, certainly of the paper and indeed of the festival. Certainly, I've got several copies, indeed many copies of the actual physical paper in front of me, including the first. But right back to things like Discover Leveson, the Leveson inquiry about the News of the World scandal. There was a lot of talk, obviously, at the early festival about that and in the paper, and then around things like the Cairn Cross Review. So just for those listeners who may not be entirely familiar with what both of those reviews were about, perhaps just highlights of Byline, take us just through those they were really about. And
there's a bit of the story which I sort of missed, really, which I think was Peter's journey to this. So Peter is a really outstanding playwright and dramatist, and has written. He's actually did last thing probably people know is he did a great radio drama series with Lenny Henry, but he's also written a lot of TV drama series and things like that. But he got quite incensed about Leveson. I mean, Leveson really. The point about the Leveson inquiry was that not only had what I talked about Google happened. What had also happened, particularly I think in the 90s, really, was and the turn of the millennium was that the press had, the tabloid press had become very, very corrupt. It had used all sorts of things, particularly phone hacking. It was incredibly easy to hack into people's answer phones and things like that. And what there were lots of cases . And what had happened was that the Leveson inquiry then sort of really looked into this. And the idea was to try and come out of it with a better press regulator and a better sort of way of looking at the press, sort of conforming much more to truth. And I think, out of that became Impress, which is a regulator as well that we signed up to with Byline.com. But what happened was that Peter attended that inquiry and he live tweeted from it. And he was given permission to do that. And what happened was that he was sitting there for so long, he needed to raise some money because, he couldn't work. He was just live tweeting all the time for the inquiry. So he asked his Twitter followers if they would support him. And I can't remember the exact amount, but I think he got £30,000 or £40,000 from his followers. And that's what really gave him the idea of doing the crowdfunding. Now we also have, sister organization which we sort of work with us under the Byline umbrella, called Byline Investigates, and this is run by two ex tabloid journalists who sort of crossed to the light side, if you like, and what's happened is they've gone on and investigated a lot of the press about their bad practices, particularly things like phone hacking and that sort of thing. And we a lot of what we did with Byline.com was to highlight that and present that. And in fact, that work by Byline Investigates, the Graham and Dan run, has led to something like $500 million of fines and things and payments and compensation payments and things that have had to be paid out by many newspaper organizations. So that was sort of, it's quite important to understand that, to understand the genesis of Byline. There was meant to be a Leveson 2 inquiry, and there were all sorts of triple locks and special sort of ways to make sure it definitely happened. And then it didn't happen. The Conservative government decided they didn't want it. So it's been a bit of a frustrating, but the Impress press regulator is up and running and that is good. And that has really helped. I think this has been incredibly important work, but I think since then, and I think when you came to the festival, that's still very important, but we've sort of moved on much more to be worried about social media and much more worried now about the complete lack of regulation in social media. And the fact that, if you're under 30, social media is probably going to be your primary source of news. And, we all know there's so much fake news that it's so difficult for anyone to find out what is actually coming from a good provenance or not. So I think that has become, and then the whole Cambridge Analytica scandal that then blew up became very, very big. And in fact, I think, it was Carol's talk in the very first Byline Festival in 2017, which for a lot of people, was the first time they'd really heard about what had been going on.
Mm. I know, I remember it very well. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. And I mean, certainly from my point of view, on a very sort of my sort of personal interest angle, I mean, yeah, my first book, The Post-Truth Business, all about the world of sort of empathy and ethics and trust and all the rest of it, and transparency. I mean, that was launched by the in the mighty Idler tent at the 2018 Berlin Festival. And I mean, certainly, I thought it was very good.
Yeah, and I think
I'm very kind.
But what was really interesting with that book, Sean, is what you did is you took that, what was going on, and then you managed to then look at it as to how it would be relevant to brands and to business as well, which I think was, very ahead of its time, really.
Yeah, thank you. It's interesting, but certainly what was fascinating, let's say, that particular year when you had the likes of Damien Collins, and I thought Damien Collins was in many ways the unsung hero of the whole thing in terms of the immense work that he did with the DCMS committee, and was then obviously stitched up by Boris and his cronies, people like either Vilt or Dominic Cummings. But certainly the talks that the likes of the wonderful Carol Cadwallader gave were just so inspiring, and her work was just phenomenal. In the days before.
Then she found Chris Wiley, didn't she, the whistleblower, and she brought him along.
Very much so, yeah.
So he was talking to fantastic. So, it was great for us, for the festival, to be able to sort of, in a way, introduce this for the first time. But, the festival is a funny old thing because it has different audiences. I think there's an audience from London that actually probably knows us quite well, but there's also an audience from a local audience, which really is drawn by the fact we have John Cleese, sort of Pussy Riot and things like that.
They
tend to come for the music and the comedy, but it's really interesting, they tend to sort of wander into the talk tents almost by accident, and then we can't get them out because that is exactly what we're trying to do with Byline. It's to try to get people to come, and who don't really think the news is that important, and get them to start looking at it and get quite fascinated on it, which is part of, where we've tried to keep developing it, and why the festival will always be incredibly important for us, because it does we love it. Families come. I remember the first festival, knowing we perhaps achieved something, when there was this sort of young mum walking along with a three-year-old and a five-year-old kid, and the five-year-old kid said to mum, "What is fake news?" And I could hear, he was sort of starting to get this conversation. Family with these young kids, and that at that point, we sort of, Peter and I turned to each other and we thought, this, we have sort of perhaps got something going here which is very interesting and isn't quite like anything else, really.
No, completely. I just thought, just that fascinating thing that, as you're saying, you can go to a talk about at that point, highlighting the horrors of those like sort of Steve Bannon and Robert Mercer and Aaron Banks, and then go and see Pussy Riot or at that point Department S, who actually I saw supporting the Jam back in the day when the mighty Vaughan Toulouse, God bless his soul, was still around. But on that, just as a slight aside, on the music side of things, because it's such an interesting mix, how do you go around, to use a dreadful term, curating that?
Yeah, it tends to be a bit more me than Peter, that, because I sort of started my life in the music business, really, and so I and that's unfortunately why we have a lot of punk, because I sort of came from that era, and Ryan's are very punk as well, but we really good. We had Loki last time, who's a really great young rap guy, Joey Bass. But a lot of the music we're curating because we want to try and get a real mix. So we had Don Letts, we had some great reggae, what we're trying to do is going to mix, but we're also very keen to get musicians who've got a little bit of political awareness too. So they're sort of for two reasons. One, because they're very cheap, because they do it as a favour. But more importantly, because, Loki's lyrics, when you listen to them, are very much, what you've been hearing. So Pussy Riot as well. And then the great thing is both Loki and Pussy Riot last year were in panels. So, most festivals you see people on, you don't get a point where, you're one of a couple of hundred people sitting, listening to them on a panel. And getting really understanding their sort of life and, but also their mission, what they're trying to do. And then 2 hours later, you can go and see them play. And I think that's very important. The more we do that, the better, really. And that's why John Cleese was such a great supporter the first couple of years as well, because he was very happy to talk and perform. And, I think you've probably seen that as well. Unlike other festivals, I mean, we tend to get those people wandering around the festival rather than just hiding the VIP bar. In fact, so much so that Nadia from Pussy Riot decided to go and wander around with her daughter around the festival quite a bit, that she wasn't allowed back into the VIP room by the security guards because they didn't recognize
her. Fantastic.
I think that's unfortunately, the really big commercial festivals have all become a bit too, you know, machine-like with, you know, stars fly in, you know, they probably own the VIP room for half an hour, then they do their performance, they go back to the VIP room for 10 minutes, and then they're whisked away, you know. We had The Feeling last year. Dan from The Feeling, who's great, was, lead singer and, you know, The Feeling there. And, you know, he was wandering around the festival having a sort of fantastic time, really upset that he could only be there for one night and wants to come for all 4 days next time. And Pussy Riot as well came for all 4 days last year. Well, the year before, wasn't it? Because we couldn't do it last year. Yeah. So I think that feeling is a bit what we're trying to do with the paper and everything, to make everything accessible and make people feel part of it, rather than, you know, there's this big corporation that's, you know, owned by a billionaire that's deciding to tell you what they want to tell you, really.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that one of the great lines that's associated with it is, you know, don't tell us what to think, show us what's happening. And that angle of just being independent means that one can go where one wants to go. So, I mean, from the point of view of dividing, as you do, things into fact, argument, reportage and culture, I was looking at the site this morning, so just things at random. So under fact, you know, a great piece about the scandal around jobs for youth in terms of jobs that never actually arrived. Great piece that Peter has done about Englishness, and perhaps we can talk about that in a while in terms of Englishness is both mine and yours and everyone's, and everyone is welcome. Reportage around Putin the thief, which obviously is the sort of thing that certainly Pussy Riot have really highlighted. And a great piece again about in terms of culture and the hospitality sector and just what's going to happen when we get out of the sort of COVID situation to find, what's going to be left, what next for all those people. A great piece that links into, things like the WAG Club and all the rest of it. So perhaps just talk us through some of those issues, Stephen, in terms of how that's all sort of set up.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting though, because I don't know what your political affiliations are, but I think most people...
Bang down the middle.
we know the middle's very important. And probably what we're trying to do is sort of radicalize the middle a little bit, really. But I think that a lot of people in the middle and on the left, are very worried about this government. And so we think as a sort of fourth estate, we should be holding the government and the establishment of the day to account. So we try to be apolitical in that sense. So I think if there was a Labour government in, we would probably be as tough on a Labour government as we are on this government. But the problem with this government is that, you know, there is a lot of cronyism. You know, there is a lot of over-promising and under-delivering. And there are over 100,000 deaths. So, you know, there's... very sadly, there's a lot of news, you know, and there's also unfortunately, a majority of the press isn't very good at delving into this. You know, a lot of the press have been quite sycophantic towards the government. I mean, that is changing a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know, but quite early on in the first lockdown, the government gave £38 million of advertising to the key press titles and advertorials and things. And it was really, you know, very much a sort of, you know, buy them off and keep them on side type thing. And in fact, they're just doing that again now, advertising things like that. So I think, you know, there's a concern, an increasing concern by people that, you know, the press is not really holding the government to account. So that's what we've been doing. So a lot of, you know, what we're talking about is that in terms of the first one you're talking about, which is, you know, another scandal where, you know, we've got a government that loves making headlines, but actually the problem is that they haven't delivered what they've been talking about, you know, and that's been really most of last year was a bit like that. You know, if you remember the numbers of PPE that were meant to be delivered, and then we found out that they were counting, you know, gloves as two pieces of PPE and things like that. And then they arrived and they were useless and all this sort of thing. So, So I think, you know, it's really important that newspapers do that. So I think the first one you talked about falls in that category. But it's very important what you talked about fact, because our feeling is that what you do is you basically lay the whole thing out, and then you know, but try not to get angry about it as you lay it out, because really what you want to do is you want your readers to then make up their own mind on those facts and then decide if they want to get angry or not, if that makes sense. So that's really the way we try to do it. I mean, the other thing that we worked out from the very beginning, which has been a real savior for us, is that we didn't want to chase a news cycle. So what happens in most newsrooms is, you know, you get in trouble if you haven't got the same story, if someone else has got a story before you, and you have to then go and find another angle on that story. And, you know, you've got to make sure we've got the same thing in our paper, really. We do the opposite. We try and look for stuff. You know, if other people got it in their papers, we're not that interested in it. We want to find the stuff that everybody's ignoring, really. So the PPE scandal, which, you know, I think in May we uncovered the first of these cronyism problems of companies that were very unsuited to go and either make PPE or usually just go and find PPE from China or something like that. You know, we had fashion companies, we had real estate companies, we had companies that had only been set up, you know, the week before and things like that. And it soon came out, the ONS said, you know, that a lot of these were just people who had connections with the government or with conservative councillors or something like that, you know, and there was no competitive tendering and all the rest of it, you know. So that's an example where, you know, we were looking at this when other people weren't. You know, we dug this up in May. Since then, we've had over 60 articles on this. But it wasn't until sort of just before Christmas, really, that, you know, it's the ONS looked at it, that it started seeping into other papers, and then, you know, the New York Times took it up and that sort of thing. So that's what we're trying to get ahead of the pack in terms of looking at stuff people don't look at. And we actually quite like it then when other people take it up later. But, you know, that's sort of the way we're trying to investigate stuff. So that's probably the first one you talked about. I think the Englishness one is very interesting, because the idea of race and identity, and also the union, because that's all to do with Brexit and everything, you know, it's a really interesting place that we actually created a documentary about it just before the lockdown. And Peter did a fantastic piece over a year ago, which was about his England, you know, explaining that his background, which was sort of Armenian and Welsh and, you know, all this sort of mixture, was what made him England, you know. And I think the problem is that England and Englishness has been hijacked a bit by the sort of St. George's flags and sort of right wing sort of thing. And it's actually been people not wanting to talk about being English, you know. It doesn't have that pride about it anymore. So I think what that article is trying to say is that, you know, Englishness is not necessarily about a point of view of superiority or exclusiveness. It's not necessarily about empire or anything like that. It's actually very different. It should be something that is very welcoming and accessible, and also has this wonderful diversity of Englishness. I mean, you know, if you think about it, you know, there are very few really indigenous English people on this island, you know. You know, my ancestors go back a long way, but they were actually Normans that popped over here anyway. So, you know, I mean, we've had waves and waves of immigration. I mean, London, you know, actually had to have immigration, because I think in the, you know, earlier times, 500 or 600 years ago, it was so unhealthy that its population kept declining because through mortality, early mortality, you know. And if it hadn't been for things like Huguenot weavers and, you know, all these different people coming in, it never would have grown. And that's what's given it its excitement and made it an international city. So I think that's what people...
Absolutely. Well, Huguenot weavers, that's my lot.
Yeah, you are. Yeah, so he was getting at. But I think then he was looking at the union itself, because the problem is, we know the union's under press. You know, we've got, you know, in Scotland, because, you know, you've got the main party is a party of independence. But also, you know, there's a fantastic feeling of sort of being ignored through the whole Brexit process where Scotland voted for Brexit, and just, you know, Westminster seeming a long, long way away and seeing very uninterested in what's going on. Obviously, you've got the pressures on the, you know, Northern, Southern Ireland, and, you know, that's pressuring the union there as well. But I think what Peter wanted to get into that article was to go much deeper into this whole idea of identity and what it actually means, and then think about what it means for the future. So, and also Hardeep Mathura, who is our editor, who's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, she's written a lot about this. She wrote a an amazing piece very soon after she started working on the paper. I started, you know, being editor, about her parents, and she wanted to find out why her parents, she comes from a Sikh background, why her parents had voted for Brexit. And it was all to do with empire and she wrote an amazing piece about this. And she has been incredibly strong on this as well as Peter, looking at empire and really the long shadow that empire casts back on this country, and particularly England as well. So I think this is going to be a theme that we're going to be, you know, has got a long time to play out yet. And we actually, it impinges a little bit on the Black Lives Matter, which we've set up a thing called Our Lives Matter, where we actually have been commissioning young and other journalists of from ethnic minorities who really don't often have a platform, and trying to commission them, and you know, we pay them the same as other writers, and creating a whole stream of articles that they've been producing as well, which is really important for us. So I think with Byline Times, it is about trying to sort of, not for a news cycle, but also it's about trying to represent communities and represent communities as well that don't really get enough space in our normal newspapers, you know, and that's that's very important to us really. And in that, really representing England and Britain as it is today, rather than a sort of rather strange, you know, sort of Brexity view of a sort of mythical 1950s England with a sort of village cricket match going on, and thinking you could impose that on the country. So I think this is something which I think is really underpins a lot of our politics at the moment.
I've got a copy of it in front of me. I'll just read one paragraph from Peter's piece. He says, Britain's imperial connections have always made England, and particularly London, one of the most diverse places in the world. The empire was built on African slaves, Irish navvies, Malaysian sailors, Indian indentured labour, Sikh soldiers. By the time my, as in his, mother was born, London had more Scottish inhabitants than Edinburgh, more Irish people than Dublin, and more Jews than the whole of Palestine. Much of this was economic, but Britain was also famed for its lack of secret police and tolerance of free speech, which encouraged Voltaire, Zola, Marx and Freud to seek asylum on our shores. Fantastic piece, has to be said. Stephen, so...
Peter is a fantastic writer, actually. Main thing with Peter is making sure that we free him up from enough of the other stuff to write enough, because he is one of our absolute top writers. Yeah. Strong on Russian, the whole Russian sort of issue as well, which I think you're talking about is probably by Sabrina Zabriskie, isn't it? But I think, you know,
the Putin the Thief piece, and you've always been very, very strong on illuminating those
Russian angles. Russian interference, which, you know, obviously stretches from everything in Ukraine, but also Russian interference on social media that, you know, you know about as well. And really, you know, understanding Putin's sort of strategy, which is really it's all about trying to cause as much, you know, mayhem in the West, really, so that nobody really spots what he's doing elsewhere, you know. And so it's slightly different from the Cold War. It's not really about people wanting to sort of invade and take over other people's countries. It's more about, you know, wanting to sort of it's a bit Trumpian in a way, isn't it? You know, wanting to make people look over to the left while you do something over on the right, you know.
Completely. Yeah, lots of false flags and endless disinformation and misinformation. Absolutely.
And also, disinformation's really cheap, you know, compared with trying to build an aircraft carrier or something. I think if you put the whole, I forget someone trying to work it out, but if you put all the money that the Kremlin's probably spent on disinformation, it's probably, you know, would only buy you one aircraft fighter, you know. And for that they managed to do so much. So it's this very, very sort of, you know, for them, it's very clever.
And I'd say also, I mean, just in terms of being an early mover on these things, how early Byline were on things like China's war on external critics and democracy, and indeed their own people.
CJ Wellman is an amazing writer for us, and CJ has been very big on the whole issue of Uyghurs, which, you know, it is like a Holocaust when you look at it.
It's horrendous.
And I think that you know, the interesting thing is, you know, not only are there millions of people in the sort of concentration camps and all this sort of thing, but also there's lots of very modern surveillance used in all this too.
You start
to find there are companies like Apple and people like that who've been dragged into this sort of this surveillance. And you know, and it does, first of all, I think it's really important that we keep raising this all the time, that the Uyghurs don't become forgotten, because, you know, the more pressure we put on it, the more important it is. But also, you know, there's a real problem, because there are a lot of corporations that are doing business and don't quite understand. So, you know, we even got to the point where in our PPE scandal, we found one of the companies that was providing PPE for the government had been previously and otherwise, you know, and potentially here sourcing, you know, PPE that had actually been made by slave labor by Uyghurs. So, you know, it's, I think there's a big point here about supply chains and brands and companies. You know, there's a massive risk if they don't really think about their supply chains. I wrote a piece about,
hugely so.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw, I wrote a piece about the despicable history of coffee and tea and sugar. And in that, I was looking at the sort of the history of coffee, tea and sugar, which is all to do with sort of slavery and this sort of thing. But
totally,
what I found was that, you know, in Brazil, there are still quite a lot of cases of modern day slavery around coffee production. Mm-hmm. And a fair amount of that coffee production is going through third parties and being sold by brands in the West as being fair trade and looking after communities and all the rest of it, because they're not really checking their supply chains. They're buying from a third party that's telling them that they've bought the coffee from a plantation which, you know, looks after its workers properly and conforms to all these standards, but it's just made up.
And
this is the real problem, that, you know, I think brands have got to really take responsibility for this and go down completely down to the end of the supply chain and find out where stuff is being sourced from. And not, you know, hide behind, you know, nice little schemes that put symbols on packs and things like that. It does need, you know, it needs, again, this is where investigation is so important, because it needs investigation, you know, people like us to then, you know, actually present this to brands so they actually see what they're doing.
No, 100%. And that's one of the things that blockchain was supposed to be enabling us to do, but hasn't quite sort of come up with the goods yet. Can I just say, just in terms of one of the other, or should say not one of the other, but, you know, the major genuinely existential issue, that of the environmental crisis and ecological sort of disaster, certainly at the last Byline Festival, and I know prior to that, Byline Times has been writing about them anyway, but the Mighty Extinction Rebellion and the movement of movements, etc. I mean, certainly at that, I mean, I saw, you know, again, obviously Roger Hallam was there along with Rupert Reed, Josie Holt gave some fantastic talks. So just in terms of the links with Extinction Rebellion and where you see them at the moment, because obviously it's been over the last year, as with everyone else, not to be glib about COVID in any way, but it, the impact has rippled out obviously in a myriad of ways, and one of the issues has been the lack of external direct action, because one hasn't been able to do so. So just talk us through the Extinction Rebellion angle with yourselves and perhaps your view on
I mean, first thing to say is that we think Extinction Rebellion is very important, because what they have done, and nobody can argue about it, they have put extinction, climate extinction at the top of the agenda, or they had done before lockdown. And, you know, I think really since the 80s, people have been talking about climate change and all the rest of it, but I think they have really broken through on that. The relationship with Byline is different, because the Byline Festival is quite activist. You know, we want to change the world. So we love the fact that Extinction Rebellion is part of the festival. And as far as we're concerned, you know, they've always got a sort of part of the festival, really, because what Byline Festival is about is getting people to actually go and do stuff. You know, you go and listen to a talk and we try and signpost to people how they can get involved in different things. So, you know, we were quite keen to encourage people to sign up for Extinction Rebellion and that sort of thing. The paper is slightly different because the paper is, you know, we have a different duty in the paper, which is the paper, as you said, is about fact, it's about reporting. It's not activist in the sense that we are telling people to go and change the world. What we're doing is we're giving them the information to make up their own minds about whether they think the world needs changing, and perhaps to give them some insights about how other people are changing the world that they could please join into. So so environmental is a very important stream as we start moving towards COP, you know, in November and everything. You know, and Extinction Rebellion is very important to us because we, you know, we want to be able to say what's going on with Extinction Rebellion. Also, you know, to be honest, there's a whole lot of papers who are very anti-Extinction Rebellion and, you know, trying to belittle them. So it's really important that we tell the truth about them. And indeed, if you look at the three demands of Extinction Rebellion, one of those top three demands is about telling the truth, which is exactly what we do. Sure. So we have a really big overlap between us. I think in terms of what they've done, I mean, they did do some really exciting stuff this year. I mean, back in our world as well was when they, you know, when they did protests outside Tufton Street, which is, as you know, a lot of the far right sort of think tanks and organizations are based in this place called 55 Tufton Street. But also when they went down and sort of stopped the presses for a while, the Murdoch presses and things like that, you know, that was interesting because it highlighted a lot of things that we try and highlight about the, you know, the rottenness of the press in this country and why it's really important that we have a better press. So, you know, I think that they have done stuff. I mean, obviously it's tricky with all these lockdown conditions, but I, you know, from my discussions with them, because obviously we're discussing with them to ask them what they're doing because we're interested in that. You know, they are planning a lot for when lockdown is over. So, you know, I wouldn't discount them. I think they'll be important. But obviously, they're just part of the whole community. And, you know, there's I think one thing we want to do, and we're very keen to do, is try and facilitate the whole sort of journalists, politicians, policymakers, activists, and try and, you know, part of that's what we want to try and do with the festival and make sure we get them all together because they tend to work in silos. And to be honest, for COP to be really successful in November, it needs all these people to work together and do stuff together. So, so yes, Extinction Rebellion is very important to us. It's incredibly important from an activism point for the festival, but it's also important for us to be able to report on them in a truthful way and without a lot of the bias and the prejudice of some of the other papers.
Mm-hmm. Since you mentioned about not only the sort of the anti-XR sort of media angle from most of them, but also the amount of think tanks have been trying to sort of undermine them. Very interesting to hear. I just wonder how many of those sort of policy wonks were sort of hovering around Byline trying to find out what was going on there.
I'm sure we have a lot of people like that, you know. But I mean, it's also a problem for XR, isn't it? Because, you know, as we know, with all big movements for change, you have a lot of undercover people and all the rest of it. So,
Very much so. I actually remember being at a policy exchange sort of event when they when the sort of deputy head of the Met was talking about whether they could or could not or were or were not allowed to put in undercover people into XR events, and I think their angle at that point was that the Met was saying they couldn't because XR being obviously deliberately so totally open and all about non-violence, and so really the police just had no idea really of how to deal with them at that point when they got going, although now with
I think in the second rebellion, slightly different. Do you remember the police went and preemptively, you know, knew where everything was being stored?
Yes, very true.
So they must, even if they, you know, must have had somebody at least giving them that information, I think. But, you know, it's always been the way, hasn't it? If you go back to Greenham Common, for instance, you know, I don't know the number, probably 10% of the people in the camp were actually undercover police or undercover police having relationships with people in tents and things like that. So been forever. Like, I think the way you deal with this, which is the way that Extinction Rebellion do it and the way we've always done with the festival and everything, is just be really open and really transparent. Because if you're really open, really transparent, and you keep everything in the public eye, then there's nothing to find out. Does that make sense? You know, I think when you start having secret meetings in back rooms, that you start having problems, really.
Mm, Well, in terms of being sort of open and transparent, it's interesting the current issue looking at it right now on my screen. So here we are, you know, I can't believe we're still only in January, and this the amount of things that have happened this month have been quite extraordinary. So here we are, America returns to truth, Britain still lost in lies. Trump's toxic legacy leaves Americans searching for a way to unite. So perhaps talk us through some of your viewpoints on Mr. Biden and the wonderful Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I mean, the first point we were making there was that, and I think we've got a very, very good investigative reporter called Nafees Ahmed, who's done a lot of work looking at the connections between Trump's administration and the people behind Trump and our current government. Mm. And, you know, he's done a lot of work to show that. And so I think the first point we were trying to make with that headline was that, you know, the problem is that though Trump has been voted out in the States, we have a government that actually had incredibly close relationships with Trump and many of his members and that sort of thing. So in a sense, you know, we are left with a, you know, America has a sort of, in some ways, escaped, you know, a Trumpian government, but we still have one. So I think that's the point we were trying to make there. I think secondarily, everybody knows that, you know, and Trump loves to say, you know, he got the biggest vote in history other than Biden's, you know. So it is a very divided nation. And, you know, that hopefully we can see from the inauguration address that Biden wants to heal those divisions,
but
it's a very tricky thing to do, and you know, a lot of those divisions also aren't just political, they're economic. And you know, even if you take Washington as a city, you know, Washington as a city, you know, I don't know if you've been there, but it looks lovely and you know all the rest of it, but it has an incredibly high number of people living in poverty, most who are African Americans, but you know, the fact is that it is a city, and it always has been. I remember, you know, looking at history books and with Hoover, and there were these Hoovervilles, which was, you know, people who were had nothing and sort of creating these encampments and things. And one of the biggest ones was in Washington.
Yeah.
So you know, and I don't know what the numbers of people living in trailers and all the rest of it are. And then above that, you've got these cases, you know, of police, you know, police murders and, you know, going on as well. And so you have a society which is going to be incredibly hard to heal. And on top of that, you have still got Trump there. You know, he's going to be there in the media or his own media or something, you know, stirring things up. So it's not a done deal. You can't just say, oh, that's great, you know, Biden's in and it's all going to be fine. It's probably, you know, it's the beginning of actually something that's going to be very tough, I think. Interesting. We are looking to take Byline Times into the States to an American edition by the midterms next year, because we feel that actually democracy is very, very vulnerable still in America. And we feel it's important for us to be there and start building up a presence in the States. So I don't know if that helps, but that's sort of our view at the moment.
Really. Yeah, totally. As we begin to finish off, I was going to ask you about what's next, but certainly Times, Byline Times US would be a wonderful thing to see. So perhaps just talk a bit more about Byline TV then. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's really exciting. I think it's back to why we did the festival, you know, this idea of trying to get to become more accessible, go to a new audience. Our worry with Byline Times is, you know, it's going so well, it's storming away, and we're building an audience. Mm. But there is a younger audience that we feel finds all sorts of media, you know, any broadsheet media really, a little bit intimidating, because a lot of people who write articles sort of expect people to understand a sort of political history or understand, you know how it works. You're writing, you know, the 10th article about Putin and Russia, and quite often you're not going back to the beginning, and people find it quite hard. It's a bit like coming in on a TV series halfway through. And so we thought Byline TV was a big, great opportunity to get to a broader audience and perhaps an audience that was interested in politics but wanted to sort of find a route into it more, as it were. And also to be able to just, you know, add to everything we're doing. We have a weekly podcast, which is going really well. So we have two young producers who we sort of work with a little bit, and we managed to persuade them to come and work with us full time. And we created a studio. We had a little studio just after Christmas a few weeks ago. We built a much bigger studio, and we can now do, we're now doing live shows. So every Friday at 7 o'clock, we have a live show with Peter and Hardeep talking about the news of the week. We're going to have lots of other shows going through the week. So our idea really is, and within the next couple of months, so every day of the week, there'll be at least one live show, which is a weekly show. So you sort of know on Tuesday it's going to happen or Wednesday it's going to happen. So we're looking at, and some of it, we're looking at a show which is a sort of a very young Jules Holland type show, sort of After Dark type show. Where we're going to get sort of comedians and musicians to talk about their work, but also particularly, you know, musicians who and comedians whose work have, you know, it's quite politically savvy, and perhaps have some pre-recorded performances and things like that. So that would be like a weekly show, and we're talking to quite a well-known presenter to do that for us, hopefully, at the moment. So so it's going to be exciting, and we did a film last week when we went and talked to a fish merchant who'd voted for Brexit and now wishes he hadn't. We went down and talked to him, and we got 2.7 million views of it on Twitter, actually, which is sort of shows they're already making sort of a bit of an impact. So the idea is we produce 2-minute films for Twitter, and they're really promos, really. They're films within themselves, but then you can go and see a sort of 6 to 10 minute film on YouTube. And then if you want to see the whole thing, you can join Patreon, which is a subscriber system. And also on Patreon, you can do things like ask questions and see all sorts of, you know, behind the scenes stuff and everything as well. And that's like £3 a month or something. So it's a bit like the business model we have on the paper, which is you go to the news site for free, and the news site gets over 1 million people a month looking at it. And then, you know, 13,000 people so far have decided they want to put their hands in the pocket for the daily newspaper. But we're also quite straight, and we say, by doing that, you help us do this for free. And it's a bit like that with the TV, that actually you can become a subscriber, and then you help pay, so everything else is free to access. We also will get a bit of money from YouTube, and then we're also making some documentaries that we're going to sell as like program sales, and we're just negotiating the first of those documentary sales at the moment. So that's Byline TV, and it's very exciting. We've been running it since September, but it's pretty tricky with lockdowns and all the rest of it. So we're very we're managing to really get some of those sort of sizes of audiences, really.
Okay. And then, in that case, the final question. So what about festival for this year then?
The truth about the festival is we don't know if we can do it yet, because don't know whether we're going to be, we have to have 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 people come to the festival to make it break even. So my suspicion is that actually gatherings over 5,000 are unlikely to be allowed this year, I think. So we can't really commit to the festival yet. So what we have done is we have found an alternative venue, which is smaller in Notting Hill. So we've got the option if it looks like we can't do the big one, of doing something smaller in Notting Hill, which would, if we had social distancing, it would take about 800 people. Without social distancing, about 2,000 people. But what we'll do is, this is where Byline TV is so brilliant, we will televise it. So so you'll be able to either come to it in person, but you'll also be able to actually see it and on TV. And I'm not talking about streaming. We'll do proper outside programming. You know, we'll create a studio in a pub across the road. We'll have our celebrities coming in there talking to us, and our journalists. You know, we'll have a couple of, you know, we'll have 2 or 3 camera crews. You know, we'll have a proper editing suite where we're choosing shots and things and different programs, and having celebrity, you know, the presenters talking and everything. So we'll create a really great show as well that you can come in and watch. So we think that's probably the solution for this year, and then look to go back to Pippingford in 2022. So and with our ticket holders, we haven't really, you know, this is all a bit up in the air because we don't know exactly what's going to happen yet. We're going to wait till after lockdown. But with our ticket holders, if they're listening, what we'll do is they'll either be able to come to the London event or they'll be able to roll their tickets over to 22, which is what Glastonbury is doing as well. So that's how we're approaching it. It's so tricky for everybody, isn't it, really? Because we just do not know. I think it, you know, if the very worst happened and we couldn't do anything, we would create something with the TV, but I think we will be able to do something smaller in London.
Fantastic. Well, look, I think our time is up there, Stephen. It's been absolutely great catching up with you on this, and it sounds just as expected, hugely exciting and massively dynamic. Just in case anyone listening isn't clear where they can track you down, yeah, go on then, just remind us.
So Twitter is at Byline Times, capital B, capital T, or at Byline TV, capital B for Byline, then just TV in capitals, or bylinetimes.com is our daily news site. So all those are worth checking out.
Very good indeed. Do that immediately. Well, that's absolutely fantastic, but unfortunately we're out of time. So what can I say apart from to Stephen Colgrave, the executive editor and co-founder of Byline Times, Byline TV and Byline Festival, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Sean. It's been great chatting to you.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.